This is Kenneth Doust, and I thank you for tuning in to this week's installment of New World Notes. Today we'll hear the second part of a two-part look at technology and society. We're featuring a talk given in 1998 by the late Professor Neil Postman of New York University. Postman died in 2003. Let's have a recap. Three acquaintances of mine have taken leave of their senses and succumbed to iPhone mania. I have tried and quite failed to perceive the charm of these electronic gizmos. To me, these expensive so-called smartphones combined all the features of a bad word processor, a bad web browser, a bad email reader, a bad camera, and a bad video game arcade. And one of my addict friends told me that a weak point is that the device doesn't work all that well as a telephone, either. Well, at least the things are harmless, except for the electromagnetic radiation you're driving into your brain. And except for the fact that a log of your location is constantly being updated and stored on your phone, and in some cases also transferred to your personal computer. How hard could it be for Homeland Security to get a glimpse of that? Other new technologies are even less useful and or even more harmful. Just to rattle off a few obvious ones, nuclear power, the natural gas mining process known as fracking, minerals mining through mountaintop removal, nuclear power, the smart grid, airport porno scanner machines, depleted uranium munitions. Did I mention nuclear power? Which brings us back to Dr. Neil Postman. We can never predict all the effects a new technology will have, he says, but we can think critically about the pluses and minuses a proposed new technology represents. And we can predict some of the effects. In a lecture of January 1998, Postman proposed six questions to ask before deciding to adopt any proposed new technology. The questions are for both the individual person and for the political unit. Last week, Postman explained the first four questions. Here they are. 1. What is the problem to which this technology is a solution? 2. Whose problem is it? 3. If this solution is adapted, what new problems might be created? And 4. Which people and which institutions might be harmed by the new technology? This week, Postman discusses two more questions. The first may seem a bit odd, but hear him out on this. The question is, what changes in language are being enforced by a new technology, and what are the effects of these changes? And the sixth question is, what people and what institutions increase their economic and political power because of this technological change? Today, it looks like no government regulator would consider asking any of Postman's six questions. The only question they now seem to ask is, will it further increase the profits of the multinational corporations? Be that as it may, at least on the level of the individual consumer, we can each ask these questions before jumping on the iPhone or whatever bandwagon. Anyway, let's hear the last part of Postman's lecture. We'll also hear a few remarks by law professor Jonathan Zittrain, an expert in internet law, on the unintended consequences of another new technology. And we'll hear still more bad news about the iPhone. How about enabling third parties to turn off your phone's ability to record videos and take pictures? A lot of big city police forces would sure love to have one of those devices. But let's start with Neil Postman.
Here's the fifth question. What changes in language are being enforced by new technologies, and what is being gained and lost by such changes? I feel sure you'll agree with me that no matter what new media come into our lives, language will remain our most indispensable medium, and that it's always a serious matter when new meanings arise or old ones are lost. Think, for example, of how the words community and conversation are now employed by those who use the internet. I was asked a couple of summers ago I'd be willing to have a conversation with Seymour Papert, who's a very distinguished technophile up at MIT. He's written some good books about it. And I said, sure, I'd be happy. When will he be in New York? The guy said, well, he's not coming to New York. He's on vacation in Cape Cod. And I said, well, I have no intention to go to Cape Cod. And they said, no, you don't understand. You will do this through email. So I said, this is not a conversation. Email is two guys typing messages to each other. Don't you agree? I mean, two guys typing messages to each other doesn't have anything about it that is similar to a conversation, or at least very little about it. So I said I would do it, but they dare not call it a conversation. I said, you can say, Postman and Papert typed these messages to each other. And then you can print it. And as for the term community, by the way, as it's used on the Internet, you should examine that very carefully, because it's almost being used in the way opposite to the usual meaning of community. Most people, when they talk about they're joining a community on the Internet, mean they've joined with people of similar interests. Now, the more traditional meaning of the word community seems to me that these are people who do not necessarily have the same interests, but who must negotiate and accommodate their differences for the sake of social harmony. So it's almost the opposite meaning. Think of how we've changed the meaning of political debate. I mean, perhaps the most interesting change. If you used Lincoln and Douglas debates as your example, you know that untypically, Lincoln would speak for 3 hours, Douglas for three, Lincoln would have an hour for rebuttal. Then they'd go to Springfield or Ottawa, and it'd be the other way around. Douglas for three, Lincoln for three, and then Douglas with an hour for rebuttal. Our version is Barbara Walters says, this question is for you, Senator Dole, after which the president, President Clinton, will have 2 minutes to rebut. What do you think is the cause of the problem in the Middle East, and how will we solve it? Now, the laugh is on us, because we say to each other next morning, did you see the debate last night? We have to think of how new technologies change meanings of words, like participatory democracy. Not long ago, I reviewed a book called The Electronic Republic. And the author argued that the new technologies will make representative democracy obsolete because they'll make it possible to have instant plebiscites on every issue. So in this way, voters will directly decide if we should join NAFTA or send troops to Bosnia or impeach the president. The Senate and the House will be largely unnecessary. And this, the author said, is participatory democracy, just as it was in Athens in the 5th century B.C. Now, I have no objection, by the way, to borrowing a phrase from an older media environment in order to conceptualize a new development. We do it all the time, but it has its risks, and we have to pay attention when it's done. To call a train an iron horse, as we once did, may be picturesque, but it obscures the most significant differences between a train and a horse and buggy. To use the term an electronic town hall meeting similarly obscures the difference between an 18th century face-to-face gathering of citizens and a packaged televised pseudo-event. To use the term distance learning to refer to students and a teacher sending email messages to each other, well, it may have some value, but it obscures the fact that the act of reading a book is the best example of distance learning possible, because reading not only triumphs over the limitations of space and co-presence, but of time as well. And as for participatory democracy, we would really be hard-pressed to find any similarity whatever between politics as practiced by 5,000 homogeneous, well-educated, slave-holding Athenians and 250 million Americans doing plebiscites every week, and I think it's dangerous to allow language to lead us to believe otherwise. Anyway, here's the last question. You'll recognize that it's related to some of the others, but I give it a special status because of its importance. Question is this: what sort of people and institutions acquire special economic and political power because of technological change? Now, this question needs to be asked because the transformation of a technology into a medium, the exploitation of a technology, always results in a realignment of economic and political power. And I don't say this as a criticism of anyone, but as a fact. A new medium creates new jobs and makes old ones obsolete. A new medium gives prominence to certain kinds of skills and subordinates others. Ronald Reagan, for example, could not have been president were it not for television. I mean, this is a man who rarely spoke precisely and never eloquently. And yet he was called the great communicator. Now, why? Because he was magic on television. His televised image projected a sense of authenticity, intimacy, caring, tradition, and it didn't much matter if citizens agreed with what he said or even understood what he said. Television gives power to some while it deprives others, and that is true of every important medium. And this fact has always been understood by intelligent entrepreneurs who see opportunities emerging from the creation of new media. And that's why media entrepreneurs are the most radical force in culture. They are interested in maximizing profits of new media and do not usually give much thought to large-scale cultural effects. America's greatest radicals have always been our entrepreneurs. Morse, Bell, Edison, Sarnoff, Disney. These men created the 20th century, as Bill Gates and others are creating the 21st. I don't know if much can be done to moderate the cultural changes that media entrepreneurs will enforce, but citizens ought to know about what is happening and keep an attentive eye on such people. Well, there are many other questions I could suggest, but for now, I stick with these six. What is the problem that this technology will solve? Whose problem is it? What new problems will be created by solving an old one? What people and institutions will be most seriously harmed? What changes in language are occurring as a result of technological change? And what new sources of economic and political power will emerge? Now, my final point is that I hope you do not have the impression that the questions I posed represent the outlook of a particular political ideology, as I see them, or at least intend them to be seen. These questions are not the questions of radicals, liberals, conservatives, or any other politics, including Luddites. The answers one gives may have an ideological cast, but the questions are those of anyone who wishes to begin understanding media, and I hope you'll take them as seriously as I do. Thank you very much. Now, I've been told we have about 10 minutes or a couple more than that for any questions you'd like to ask or comments you'd like to make or compliments you'd like to give me. And I'd be happy to, if I can.
You said that electronic media has irreversibly changed the character of our symbolic environment. And you say that much of our conversation happens through symbols and metaphors. Could you speak more about how it affects our religious discourse?
Who are you? In what spirit do you ask this question? I do have a chapter in the book you're holding. I think I call it Shuffle Off to Bethlehem, and try to make the point there that, speaking mostly about television there, the television tends to be hostile to the idea of religion. In part, I mean, for a lot of reasons. One of them is that I think it encourages blasphemy. Some of the old-timers in the audience will remember when there was a Catholic priest on television, Bishop Sheen. Do you remember Bishop Sheen? And he was very handsome and very dramatic and charismatic. And except maybe for the Milton Berle show, his program may have been the most watched TV program of the time. He was taken off the air, not by TV, but by the church, because people began to love Bishop Sheen more than Jesus or more than God. Television has that power to create icons. And so Sheen was taken off television. They sent him, I don't know where, some place like Rochester, New York, and he was never heard from again. Billy Graham, I'm sort of rambling here, because it's such a vast subject. Billy Graham, Jesus said, doesn't Jesus say, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there I am. Now, Billy Graham thinks that wherever 30 million people are gathered in Jesus' name, Billy Graham is there. The point, just to be simple, because we don't have as much time as we would need, here's the point that I was trying to make. That, well, first of all, television always tries to provide people with what they want. And enduring religions do not do that. Religion provides people with what they need, not with what they want. And so you have a clash of two different institutions. And if you've looked at the kinds of religious programming they have on television, mostly done by evangelicals, it's strictly, it's done like any television show. It's just organized like a television show, as, by the way, are news shows. It's always interested me, if someone can explain this to me, I would really appreciate it. Why on news shows do they have music? Has it ever struck you as odd that they're about to give you stories about earthquake, an earthquake in Chile and a huge fire in Chicago, and it all begins with music, which stays throughout the show as a sort of motif? Well, maybe it's just a question. I don't know the answer to it.
Neil Postman, speaking in 1998 at Calvin College. That was way before smartphones, but his remarks still apply 13 years later. Speaking of smartphones, Apple's iPhone was back in the news. And again, the news is bad for the gizmo's owners. This is from Technology News, June 21, 2011. Apple patents camera shutoff technology. Apple has filed a patent for technology that would allow owners of concert venues to disable video recording in cell phones, such as Apple's ubiquitous iPhone, during concerts. The technology would work through software on the handheld device that is triggered when concertgoers hold up their phones, exposing them to infrared sensors in the concert venue. The patent has yet to be implemented in any known commercially available device. It is unclear if the technology extends to still pictures, but it is likely that it does, as the still camera uses the same components in the device. This patent only expands upon the debate over just how much control consumers have over the electronic devices they purchase. Admittedly, most concert venues already have rules preventing patrons from filming events. But should such rules extend to allowing venue owners or technology companies to disable electronic devices? Internet law expert Jonathan Zittrain spoke at the University of Hartford in October 2010. Here's a good story he told about those devices in some cars that automatically summon help in an emergency. It's a great example of unintended negative consequences of new technology. These devices give the national security apparatus a powerful new tool to spy on you and to eavesdrop on everything said in your car. Here's Jonathan Zittrain.
So, for example, some of you may have the OnStar system in your car. People have OnStar in their GM car. Have you seen this little button? And it gives you turn-by-turn directions, or here's what it looks like in the rearview mirror. And there's a little help button, and if you're in trouble, you press it, and you're like, help, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. And this woman, this is the actual woman, is like, don't worry, we know where you are. We're sending help. So the FBI realizes that this exists. And there's a car, a GM car, being driven by some people, served by an OnStar-like service, but not OnStar. And the FBI is like, you know, we want to know what's going inside that car. So they talk to the OnStar-like company. They're like, please send a software update that turns on the microphone in the rearview mirror at all times. The company does this, and then has a litter of kittens, and sues in the bravely titled case, The Company versus the United States of America. Because if you knew who they were, you wouldn't buy their cars. So the company sues, saying we shouldn't have to do this. And that gets litigated. District court opinion is issued in the government's favor under seal. It then goes on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit reverses on the thinnest of reeds. The Ninth Circuit says that because the way it was implemented, even if the bad guys, the people of interest in the car, get into trouble and they ask for help, it will still only go to the FBI, which presumably would not come and help. So that's not fair. You have to make it so that when they ask for help, it three ways in the happy lady, and then it sends help, and then that's fine. That is the current state of law in the U.S. for covert surveillance using these tools. And we see the same thing with any smartphone. You could just send a firmware update to the phone, turn on the microphone. You don't have to be on a call. It's not to listen to your calls. It's to listen to you. And just turn it on and beam it up or save it so the next time you dock, it transfers the call over and then sends it over the internet to the government. Now, this is starting to sound like tinfoil hat territory, but it's exactly where we are at, amazingly, through our own choices in products. So you might say then, All right, what we have is a new path of infringing on individual liberties, sometimes encouraged by the government, but in any case mediated through the corporate space. How do we deal with that?
Jonathan Zittrain. And before that, technology news and part two of Neil Postman. All spoke on the downsides of new technology and, at least implicitly, the desirability of discussing and debating any new technology before adopting it willy-nilly. For every gain a technology produces, there's a loss, and we might think about who will be gaining and who will be losing. I'm going to go out on a bit of music. But first, thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Here's a parting thought. The new technologies Postman discusses were fairly innocuous. The supersonic passenger jet, computers in schools, television. But let's not forget that most American technological innovation is devoted to ever more efficient weapons of destruction, enabling the U.S. military to take control of most nations on Earth. And let's remember that when these weapons are used abroad, the people killed are rarely wearing a uniform, except the nurses, ambulance attendants, and schoolchildren. Here's a bit of Bruce Coburn on the U.S.-funded right-wing campaign of terror against the people of Guatemala in the 1980s. It's called If I Had a Rocket Launcher. Ciao.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody's scattered, and the hopes it goes away. How many kids they murdered, only God can say. I would not hesitate.